I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Ahead this hour, Newcastle County's homeless population will find shelter from the cold in a hotel purchased by the county and redubbed the Center of Hope. We'll have more on the story coming up. We'll also profile the late blues singer Frank Bay, who at times called Philadelphia his home. Bay's album, All My Dues Are Paid, has been nominated for a Grammy Award. But first, new COVID-19 vaccines are offering hope to a pandemic-weary nation. But for many, the promise of an eventual return to normalcy is tempered by the harsh reality of the here and now. For hundreds of thousands of families in the tri-state area who've been hammered by unemployment, the holidays are marked by worry that they will lose their homes to eviction, even as Congress is expected to extend an eviction moratorium set for New Year's Eve. However, the uncertainty around such a safety net is especially worrisome in a city like Philadelphia, whose poverty rate consistently hovers at about the 25% mark. To start the hour, we'll discuss how the pandemic has affected the ability of many to pay rent, and we'll also catch up to Philadelphia's new eviction diversion program. Tony Abada is with Community Legal Services, which provides free civil legal assistance to low-income Philadelphians, and he's been helping to implement the eviction diversion program. Welcome, Tony.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about those who've become the most vulnerable to eviction because of the pandemic. Who are you hearing from at Community Legal Services these days?
It's really a broad range of folks who are really struggling, some for the first time, but some that have, you know, been struggling since before the pandemic, that are, you know, facing the risk of homelessness through the eviction process.
How has the pandemic exacerbated the challenges facing some of these families, Tony?
I think it's made it really difficult because we kind of see that the pandemic is making eviction a threat to public health. So it's becoming a situation where before you could have called it sort of a business, but now it's sort of like a public health issue. And the eviction landscape itself, even before the pandemic, where we saw maybe 19,000 evictions a year or eviction filing, is really sort of unacceptable at this period of time with a pandemic raging around us.
So when you say eviction is a threat to public health, tell us more about what you mean by that.
So unfortunately, sort of housing instability, and typically you might think of sort of homeless people who are unhoused, but even people who are sort of like couch surfing or between places or sort of unable to make ends meet and forced to move out is really putting us all at risk because there's households that are now, you know, sharing more people, people having to move around, relocate.
So sure, more at risk for the coronavirus and spread, community spread. Tony Abada, most eviction cases have traditionally ended up in court. What are the difficulties faced by tenants and landlords in this scenario?
Yeah, so the court process is sort of, it's been used, I think, for a lot of different purposes. You know, with those 19,000 filings even before the pandemic, it was kind of used as a forum to even have a conversation between a landlord and a tenant, which is why it's exciting that we've been able to get this eviction diversion program off the ground, which is an opportunity in a lower stakes environment to have a conversation between a landlord and a tenant, connect with available resources, and try to resolve this without having to go to the high stakes sort of environment of a court process.
So what sort of success is it seeing?
It's been exciting. We've been able to get the program off the ground. Obviously, there's a whole partner, a group of partner organizations working very hard, training mediators, getting nonprofit housing counselors up to speed to actually help tenants and landlords. And so far, we've seen about a 77% success rate or repayment plans entered into when both the tenant and the landlord show up for the mediation.
Okay. We have a comment from Kate who says it's a crime against humanity to put people out into the street in the middle of the winter with the cold and the virus. I am a landlord and have not kicked out the tenants, even though I'm losing money. It's an outrage that the government is not helping landlords. So Kate is trying to keep moving forward, even though she's losing money and keeping tenants in place. It's an outrage that the government is not helping landlords. let's talk about, and actually let's follow that up with a comment from Claire, who says, I was sickened to learn that Pennsylvania tenants and homeowners missed out on $108 million of $175 million in federal coronavirus relief because state programs distributing the funding made it too hard to access. Even more disheartening is a bill to rectify the issues of access and extend the deadline was unanimously passed by the House, but never advanced to the Senate. How does this happen? Who is responsible? We've got a number of points here from both of these listeners, but I guess the overarching question is, how has the state failed renters and landlords in distributing coronavirus funding, CARES Act funding, in trying to keep people in place, Tony?
Yeah, that's a really big question. I think what's exciting about the eviction diversion program is that we've been able to bring together sort of both sides in the conversation piece, but then also it's really about connecting with those resources like rental assistance. Here in Philadelphia, you know, there were tens of thousands of people who applied or tenants who applied for rental assistance, but then for various reasons, and sometimes it was just confusion about what it meant or what the restrictions were, some landlords either didn't know or didn't participate, so they sort of missed out on this, what you might call free money for rental assistance. So one of the exciting parts about the eviction diversion program is we're able to line up in tenants with a housing council to actually apply for assistance. And then in that conversation between the landlord and the tenant, housing council is actually there as well, along with the trained mediator, sort of explain what are the programs that are out there, why you would want to participate, how you actually do participate, what to follow up on. So it's exciting to sort of clear up, because sometimes people say, we just need more money. Yeah. Which we do need more money, right? We need more rental assistance. But there's also a key piece of it, which is a conversation and understanding of what do these programs mean? Do I want to participate? And that's where the eviction diversion program comes in. It's a sort of lower stake environment or conversation where you can actually connect people.
Can it serve enough people, though, Tony? We're talking about thousands of families living on the bubble here. Can the eviction diversion program access all of them or bring all of them into the conversation, or is there just really room enough for a few hundred?
So that's a good question. I think it's a question of sort of resources. We've been able to scale up fairly quickly from doing about maybe 10 to 12 mediations per week at the very beginning to over 90 mediations per week as we've gotten the program up and running. And, you know, with additional resources, we think it's possible to continue. And we're really building this program off of what's been very successful, which is the mortgage foreclosure diversion program here in Philadelphia that's been able to handle the volume consistently over the last 10 years. So there is sort of a model out there that can make this work. There's still some moving pieces, but we are seeing some positive advances.
Okay. I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse, but Congress has, in its recent stimulus package approved over the weekend by Congress, apparently is allocating $25 billion more for rental assistance. And that, of course, is money that goes across the country. But for whatever might end up in our neck of the woods in the Pennsylvania area, are you hearing that the rules might change a little bit, you know, at least on the state level, so that people who are applying for this assistance can actually access it?
Yeah, so long story short, no, I don't have any insider information or knowledge on that, but it's definitely something that's been in the conversations about some of the limits of the programs that have been set up during the pandemic, sort of the access to information and also like access to the resources, how to apply, how to get your complete application in. So I think we're kind of learning as we go. So I think there will be sort of advances in distributing and getting access to the aid. And I actually think eviction diversion can be like a key point for like if people have questions and like if landlords have concerns, getting those actually addressed so that we get the money out the door.
It's estimated, Tony, that Pennsylvanians across the board will owe about $958 million in back rent in January. So for the folks for whom back rent has been piling up, they're unable to pay partially or fully. The debt is overwhelming. How does the eviction diversion program help here?
Yeah, so I think even in situations where there's a bunch of money owed and maybe because some of the rental assistance ended actually recently, so we've been having even continuing conversations. And really, the eviction diversion program is an ability for both sides to also get heard and sort of listen to what the circumstances are, because it's really easy, even from a tenant's perspective, to think, you know, landlord's just not doing something, or the landlord's saying, I don't understand why this tenant isn't paying me, to hear both sides and sort of come up with a plan, even if that plan is, we're going to check in next month because there's new programs coming out, which now there's this $25 billion federally, it looks like, yeah, for emergency rental assistance, so that we're not just jumping into the court process and saying, well, now we need to evict. Because, again, coming back to the first point, if eviction is part of sort of a threat to our, you know, public health, we have to do everything we can to try to avoid that.
Yeah. Well, my understanding is, you know, one, you know, according to the Inquirer, rather, some landlords own almost half of Philly's rental units, and the city relies on them to provide affordable housing. So if they're trying to hang on and they're trying to keep tenants in place, but they're not getting the funding, what recourse is available to them through the eviction diversion program to keep them going as they try to keep tenants in place?
Well, sort of part of the understanding of sort of, I guess, the business side of things, which I'll, you know, be the first to say I'm not an expert on, but sort of understanding sort of being able to predict where is revenue going to come from, when can I, you know, have some income, how can I tell the people I report to or the debts that I'm paying on sort of what's happening. And I think the eviction diversion program gives us an opportunity to, like, set up a plan. So this is sort of what to predict going forward, or, you know, where the tenant's actually at right now. So even if it's a reduced amount, which we have seen landlords, tenants enter into agreements that were like, if your rent was $1,000, I can pay $800 for the next 2 months while I try to recover and then sort of figure out what the next steps are. So even having some idea of some income stream can be helpful, I think, through the program.
Yeah, sure. The eviction diversion program is not permanent at this time. It runs through the end of March. Any indication there might be an extension?
So I would say, you know, the program's mandate for landlords to participate is through the end of March, which was just approved through the city council. But I think there is a lot of sort of general support, not only from the advocate side of sort of tenant rights, but also in terms of landlords that have actually participated in the program, that there's a lot of support for saying, hey, this seems to have some role to play. It's very useful for us to understand what's actually happening. And it seems to be that there's some support in some form that this will continue going forward even after that date. And we know we can't really go back to normal, right?
Yeah.
Even as much as, you know, having the vaccine rollouts makes us feel like we have some sort of timeline, but especially in the eviction cases where you were filing 19,000 eviction cases even before the pandemic, no one wants to go back to a world where we have these mass filings happening. So having some program to bring the sides together and see if we can address this without going to court seems to be sort of mutually beneficial.
All right, Tony Abbata, thank you so much for joining us on the Regional Roundup.
Thanks again.
Tony is a paralegal with Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. Up next, we talk about an unusual partnership in Newcastle County, Delaware, which has turned a former Sheraton hotel into a space for the homeless over the winter. We'll hear more about that story straight ahead. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Today marks the first official day of winter, even as frigid weather has been with us for the better part of a week now. For those without shelter, this sort of weather can be brutal and even deadly. Many cities and towns enact emergency declarations designed to bring the homeless inside and away from icy conditions. But the pandemic is complicating the situation as the essentials of warmth and lodging have expanded to include the need for distancing. This hour, we're going to take a look at Newcastle County's answer to the challenge. The administration of County Executive Matt Meyer has worked with County Council to purchase a little-used Sheraton hotel, transforming it into an emergency shelter for people who are homeless. Kim Eppenheimer joins us now to tell us more about this story. She is Executive Director of Friendship House, a support center serving people without shelter in the Wilmington area. Hello, Kim. Good to have you with us.
Hi, the pleasure is all mine.
And we also have County Executive Matt Meyer with us for the first few minutes of the show. Hello, Matt.
Hi, good morning, Mary. Great to be here.
Good morning to you. Good morning to you both. And as always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So, Matt, let's begin with you. How did the idea to convert a hotel into a shelter come about? We're talking about actually purchasing the hotel to do this.
That's right. Well, when the virus first hit our community, our top two priorities was, number one, a public health priority, doing everything we could to identify the virus in our community and eradicate it insofar it was possible. And second, to identify the most vulnerable populations and make sure we were putting all the resources we had to bear to protect them. And so we put together a task force, particularly to look at most vulnerable populations, a task force of community leaders. And one of the strategies they suggested was acquiring vacant properties, you know, hotels, to house most vulnerable people and keep them safe throughout the pandemic.
And this particular hotel, which is a Sheraton, was kind of off the beaten path. I think it even has a nickname, the Swamp Hotel. Wasn't getting a whole lot of business. So an ideal location, Matt?
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say it wasn't getting a lot of business. I know that, like a lot of hotels, it was not thriving, right? It was
so not
right
enough business.
I-95.
Yeah.
It was certainly once COVID-19 hit, that was sort of the death knell, I think, for that business during normal times. I think it was, at least there's an argument, it was a viable business. But so we were looking around trying to think of more permanent solutions. In addition, starting in, I believe it was April, in collaboration with the state government and other municipal governments, we were providing vouchers, and actually still are, for individuals experiencing homelessness or transient to go to motels. So, for example, I did a food distribution at a Red Roof Inn just on Saturday, and that's still going on. The problem with that is it's just sort of a place to stay. Many of the rooms don't have Wi-Fi, for example, or don't have fast enough Wi-Fi so that all the children across the motel could get into their Zoom classrooms. And so the idea was, how do we develop a facility very quickly that provides dignity and also provides a host of wraparound services that maybe, just maybe, will be sort of not only a great safe facility for COVID times, but one of the best facilities serving, homeless populations in the state or even in the country.
Let's bring Kim Eppenheimer into the conversation. Kim, again, is Executive Director of Friendship House, which is working with the Center of Hope. So let's kind of roll the clock back a little bit, Kim, and talk about, you know, pre-pandemic, when you were working with people without a shelter at Friendship House and a code purple alert would be implemented, which I guess happens when the temperature dips below 20 degrees. Friendship House would typically open its doors to people needing shelter overnight, and volunteers would bring food and sandwiches and et cetera. But the pandemic really threw a monkey wrench into all this. Tell us about the logistical challenge of trying to keep people safe.
Yes, and you explained it perfectly. Pre-pandemic, we had a wonderful support of donated space from our partners, our worshiping communities, and volunteers that would really help make sure that there were enough options for people who are experiencing homelessness on those most cold nights. As we were getting close to fall and in the middle of fall, we realized we cannot do what we've done in the past with COVID and with this pandemic. And as an organization, we really started to look at what could our options be, and we were getting very anxious, not having a good opportunity or a good solution to the problem. The logistics of putting people up for the night, you know, if you're doing one night, two nights in a row, there's less that's needed right away. You know, they need shelter, and they need a place to use facilities and have water and have the most necessities. It was a great opportunity for us to be able to get to know our folks and volunteers to meet them and eat with them. And none of that's possible with COVID. Having this opportunity to have a hotel where we could put people in and keep them here was a brilliant move of the county. It definitely has other logistic difficulties. We are very aware that we have pulled people out of what they know. You know, they've been camping for some months, for others years, and they've worked out a system to make that feasible for that moment in time. But COVID has really made it very, very difficult for them. But we still were pulling them out of where they know. So putting them into a space like this, the logistics were something we have spent weeks thinking through and working out to make sure that when they were here, then we could really make sure that they're stable and they're safe and they're getting what they need.
Well, let's talk about more about what they are getting to help with the adjustment process. I know there are amenities such as fresh towels and linens and hygiene products, but helping them to adjust and also separately, you know, quite often people do refuse shelter, even on dangerously cold nights, because they don't want to be inside with, especially near other people. So tell us how you help them work through this.
Right. And that's very true. So they are getting extra amenities, which is here for them. And it's been a beautiful thing. We've had many people on the first day that we brought them their meal. They cried out of just relief. They are amazed that this is their new home. They really are adjusting pretty well. Many of them are figuring out how to ensure they still get what they need and want. And they're really doing well abiding by our requests, which is a huge gift to us as well. It's sort of teamwork to make sure everyone is staying safe. We are making sure that they get, you know, like you said, the fresh towels and linen. So it's got a little bit of that hotel feature. But at the same time, we have limited resources. So we're also being very thoughtful to make sure that everybody is getting all that they need. In reference to those that did not take us up on this offer, that are still living at their campsites, it's very difficult for people to understand, and it's hard to accept their answer. For some, they know that they just won't do well in this environment. Either they're worried they might break a rule and then lose other benefits. There are people that don't understand that even if they maybe are potentially wanted for a small violation that is fixable, they're still scared that coming inside, especially a county building, might, you know, they might get arrested. For others, they have found a campsite that is really effective for them. It's very tucked away. They've spent some time building up a small shelter. They have a strong tent and a good sleeping bag, and they're scared of losing it. Our hope is for people that are here that they move into permanent housing from here, and we're not kicking them out the day that winter ends, but to really work with them on their next steps. But it's hard to really believe that if that has never been an opportunity for you in the past. And so the idea of coming in and losing what you've spent years building was something very scary for people.
No,
therefore,
Matt,
the county purchased... Oh,
No, finish your thought, Kim.
Oh, I was just going to say the county purchased additional tents and sub-zero sleeping bags that we are actually making sure we get to those folks so we can make sure they stay safe.
And that was actually my next question to Matt, because I know we've only got you for a few minutes, Matt Meyer. How long will the Center of Hope be able to house people 24/7? I understand it's through the winter, but are you looking to do this beyond? And is the funding there?
So the first thing is the bottom line for us is this is about dignity and letting people in the community who think we don't care about them, who think we've forgotten them, letting them know that we care about them. And that's true in a pandemic, and that's true after a pandemic is over, right? So that's sort of at a high level. Now you're asking, where's the money coming from and how are you going to manage? We right now have, thanks to the great work of our, you know, our senators and congresswomen, in Washington, we have stimulus funds that clearly provide us funding to fund this through June of 2022. So for the next 18 months, our intention is to continue it as a transitional shelter like this for as long as the pandemic is impacting communities. Once that subsides or ends, whether it ends suddenly, you know, next week or in 2 weeks or in 2 months or in a year or 2 years or 3 years, we obviously don't know right now. And then at that point, we'll take a look at the post-corona world. We'll look at the affordable housing situation, and we'll make sure this facility is put to use in the way most reasonable at that time.
All right. County Executive, Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Kim Eppheimer, back to you. So I understand that pets are welcomed at the Center of Hope?
That is correct, yes.
Are they allowed to stay in rooms?
They are. We have four dogs and one cat that are currently here. They were ones that were previously owned, and the dogs were living with their owner. We really wanted to make sure that people didn't have to leave much behind. We wanted to prevent as many barriers as possible. And anyone out there who has a pet that is a family beloved treasure, you know that is not something you'd want someone to take away from you.
Oh, yeah.
So we are thrilled to be partnering with Faithful Friends, who is offering services to make sure that all animals are up to date with their shots, that they have rabies. They're offering neutered and spayed surgeries to make sure that we can do it safely and well. And so far, it's going very well.
So let's get to one of the more serious notes of the conversation, and that, again, is the presence of the coronavirus. Let's talk a little bit more about protocols and what happens if somebody were to be diagnosed with COVID-19 while they're staying at the Center of Hope.
Yes, we're following the CDC guidelines and the county guidelines, so being very strict on ensuring when anyone is in a public space, they are wearing their mask and reminding people to do it properly. Anytime someone enters the building, they go through the protocol of getting their temperature checked and they answer the key questions. And we're tracking when people are here. So should there be someone that tests positive, we'll know their comings and goings, hopefully knowing who they've been around. If somebody should test positive who is already living here, we have part of the top floor, the sixth floor, is quarantined so that we can ensure they're only using the same elevator and nobody else is. There's additional plexiglass. There's signs everywhere to make them stay and keep people away. We will still provide their food and get them what they need, but we are asking them to quarantine fully until they test negative. If they're showing any symptoms, we ensure that they get the medical help they need through telehealth, phone calls, et cetera, so that they're well taken care of.
So if they come in and they're diagnosed as they are coming in seeking shelter, then are they quickly rerouted to the top floor?
If we can, yes. There is a hotel in the county that is designed specifically for known cases of COVID. So if we could get them there, we would. But if this is their place, then yes, we even constructed in the intake area a specific way so they can keep them separate so they wouldn't ever have to interact with anybody else.
Let's take a look at what's going on in, not too far away, Philadelphia. A loss of federal funding has prompted Philly to begin to move approximately 200 homeless people out of two hotels in Center City. I believe that's beginning today, and into other accommodations. Only about a quarter at this point are going into permanent housing. Philly officials say they are moving heaven and earth to provide long-term housing opportunities. And you referenced this a little earlier in the conversation, Kim. It is challenging. Speak to this from your perspective about the process of finding long-term housing and even jobs for people who might be at the Center of Hope right now.
It is admittedly a very difficult process. There are many reasons that people are at that point of experiencing street-level homelessness. Not everyone is at a point that they can just pick up a job and maintain it, especially if they've been out of work for years. It takes some training. It takes some thoughtfulness. And especially if you've been living on the street for quite a while, that transition to then maintaining your own space and understanding the responsibilities also takes time. That's one reason that we at Friendship House believe so wholeheartedly in transitional style living, so that you're not just put into a location, but you're going with resources and with education and with help so that you can really maintain that as a goal. So for here at the Hope Center, that's something we're going to really look at. We already have people who are saying, I'm here, I'm ready to think about work. And so we want to talk to them and say, well, how will that work for you? We have a shuttle that takes people from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. to local bus stops so they can get where they go. So how will that work with your work schedule? If you're here and you have other responsibilities, how is that going to fit into it? And then once you're there, how do you maintain your employment? It's an opportunity for us to really work with them because we're going to see them here every day. So we don't just push them off and then say, okay, good luck, but let's hold your hand through that process to make it really sustainable. In terms of housing, I think the difficulty is making sure there's a good supply. And that's one issue that I know is high on many people's list is now that we have them here, if they all wanted to go to stable housing, is there a supply sufficient
is
for
there?
Them?
Is there?
Do you we're worried that there may not be.
Okay.
Yeah. Affordable housing is, I think, a nationwide concern, and not just affordable, you know, the way that maybe you or I may think of it affordable, but truly affordable for those that are working those lowest paid jobs. Can they truly make it on their own if it's a single or a couple or a family with one or two low income wage earners? How can they make that sustainable? And that's something that we really work with people on, our budget thoughtfulness. How can you do this with kids? We try to look at the whole picture very holistically for each person.
Is there enough room at the Center of Hope for all those who might be homeless in the Newcastle County area?
No.
And so what is available to them once the Center of Hope fills up?
If we fill up, and that would mean that we are at our max to every room, we even could, if we had to do congregate shelter living in the ballroom, we would find a way to do it safely. If that is at capacity, there is still other shelter options. There's the Sunday Breakfast Mission in Wilmington that pretty much never will turn anybody away as long as they can either. And I know they've been taking a large brunt of people who are experiencing homelessness through COVID. I am convinced that the county, if we get to that point, then that they would work with us to find more space. I have complete faith in seeing how they've pulled this together, the amazing teamwork, how much passion they've put into this. It doesn't stop here. If more space is needed, more space will come about.
Kim Eppenheimer, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have you with us, and good luck with your work.
Oh, thank you so much for this opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
Kim Eppenheimer is Executive Director of Friendship House, which is working with the Center of Hope in Newcastle County, Delaware. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we hear about the late Philadelphia blues man, Frank Bay, who has been posthumously nominated for a Grammy Award. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Now you all know the story, how it all began. It took 5 days, and then came man. Oh, the land was free, and so...
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and that was from the song Idle Hands from Frank Bay's 2020 album, All My Dues Are Paid. The Grammy Awards happened January 31st, and among the nominees is the late Frank Bay. His album has been nominated for Best Traditional Blues Record. Bay spent part of his life in Philadelphia and indeed was living near the city when he passed away in June after a 15-year battle with kidney disease. His long career was marked by highs and lows, the lows including a bitter misunderstanding with singer James Brown in 1977, which led Bay to walk away from his music for years. He eventually embraced the blues again, and the president of NOLA Records says some of his best work came later in life. Now, a documentary about Frank Bay is in the final stages of production. We're going to spend the rest of the hour taking a look at his life and listen to some of his music. Sally Bengston is president of NOLA Blue Incorporated. Hi, Sally. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
And Tom Dwyer is executive producer of the documentary Frank Bay, You're Going to Miss Me. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mary. Thank you. And it's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's great to have you both with us. So Frank Bay was born in 1946 in Georgia, the seventh of 12 children. His mother was gospel singer Maggie Jordan. Let's start with you first, Tom. Tell us a little bit about his early life and how he came to Philadelphia.
When he was a child, his mother was a preacher. She was the first African-American female preacher in Georgia. And so there was a lot of religious activity around Frank's home, and all kinds of gospel groups at the time, Blind Boys of Alabama, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Sam Cooke, when he was still doing the gospel circuit, would come through their church in town. And that had a big influence on Frank, so much so that when he was 4 years old, he joined a touring gospel group with, I think there were three cousins, and they actually toured throughout the South. And that was really the beginning of his music, love of music. Now, as he told the story to us, as he got a little older, he was attracted to the other side, the music that would come out of Memphis. He lived in a small rural town in Georgia called Millen. It was a one industry town. They basically were a cotton town, and it was still the Jim Crow era. But he would listen on Sunday nights to the music that came out of Memphis and Nashville. His mother didn't really approve of that, but he was hooked. And there was a man in town that he would tell the story that he would play a guitar on a street corner, and he only had three strings on his guitar, but Frank was really enamored of that. Mm. And that's really how Frank got attracted to the music. Eventually, Frank, when he was about 17 years old, he felt that Millen was a sort of place where he couldn't really do what he wanted to do musically. And so he left Millen and he moved to Philadelphia.
Sally, some called Bay the Southern Gentleman of the Blues. How did he end up with this nickname?
You know, I'm not certain how he came up with the nickname, but he certainly embodied it. He really had a quiet humility and strength about him, just so much integrity and pride in the way he carried himself. He truly, there was no better name for him than that.
Yeah, and yet he did have a rough go at times during his career, some real ups and downs. We're going to get into that in just a bit. But first, we did promise some music. We've got the title track from Frank Bay's album called All My Dues Are Paid. And let's play that clip right now.
I was born way down in Georgia, 1940s, black and poor. It took every bit of strength I had to try to crack that Jim Crow door.
Sally, you know, Frank was apparently one of the lucky ones. You told our producer, John Ahrens, that there are more artists like Frank Bay out there, people who live in poverty and obscurity with amazing talent that's born of their suffering, and that there aren't that many left.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've had the honor, really, and privilege of working with three such gentlemen so far in the career of my record label. Started with Benny Turner, who was born in East Texas and was brother of the late Freddie King, who's an inductee in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, known as one of the three kings of the blues. Benny had an amazing career, not only supporting his brother as a sideman, but a sideman in other roles as well. Now he has emerged in his own glory as a frontman and a skilled producer, songwriter, recording artist. That's been a wonderful thing for him. He's 81 years old and still going strong. We also released music from the late Cash McCall, who was a big player, sideman on the Chicago blues scene, the Chicago soul scene. We lost Cash last year, but same kind of thing. It was a really, really sweet time for him in the sunset of his career to have the spotlight shining on him for a change, and instead of being in the shadows of the greats that he supported.
So, Tom, back to you. Some of the challenges that Frank Bay experienced included a record deal gone wrong with fellow singer James Brown, which ended with Bey actually stepping away from his singing career for, what, about 17 years? And I think working as a yellow cab driver? What happened there?
Well, to make this really intriguing story really short, he was in a band called the Moorish Vanguard, and they were a local Philadelphia band, and they toured, and they really had were probably at the cutting edge of the funk movement. If you know Tower of Power and Sly and the Family Stone, some of those bands, they had this sound that was absolutely outstanding. They were touring in the South. Frank had a relationship with James Brown, who lived in Augusta, Georgia. And on a tour that they were doing in the South, they decided, well, Frank arranged for the band to go to James Brown's studio and to cut a record. They cut the record, and about 6 weeks later, while they were on the road, the record came across the radio, and the band had no credit. It was a James Brown production created by James Brown, and the band was deflated. And they thought that Frank had colluded with James in some way. And the story is really rather sad, because they would stay in different motels. The band would stay in the travel van that they would go from town to town in. Frank would go into a motel because he'd have access to a phone. Frank was the manager of the band. That night, the band abandoned Frank with nothing, no clothing, no money, no anything. And the story of how he got home was interesting enough. But what happened was that was really the end of the band. Frank was really deflated, because the band represented some fundamental values and morals that Frank really believed in, with regard to truth and honesty and justice and love and peace and those sorts of things. And so he just decided to leave music. And he had a whole number of different jobs. He came back to Philadelphia. He worked as a cab driver. He worked in construction. What's interesting is if you see the list, it's amazing. He became a bird tamer. So if you had like a parrot that would bite people or curse too much, you could give it to Frank, and he would make it a good bird. But
that's pretty wild.
Really crazy. Eventually, though, to get back into music, there was a fish store that he went to, and run by two women, and he saw that it wasn't doing well. He and his wife took the fish store over, and immediately the profits began to rise. Mm-hmm. And around the corner was a bar called Smith's Bar in North Philadelphia. And he said, I think I'd like to buy that place and make it an upgraded restaurant. He did that. After a while, decided to bring in music. And after it was running for about 2 years, there was a band on the stage, and the people in the room that night were really going crazy about the music they had done. And the guy who was leading the band said, oh, you think I'm good? You ought to get that guy in the back who's cooking. Come on up, Frank.
Really?
And Frank sticks his head out of the door, and he's covered with flour and an apron and has a spatula. And he gets up onto the stage, and he tears the house down. And so about 6 weeks later, much to her chagrin, Frank told his wife, Tony, I'm going to sell the restaurant and go back into music. And that's how it all got back.
So Sally, Frank Bey eventually approached you and your label to record. And you say that some of his best work came in his later years.
Absolutely. And Frank didn't approach me directly. I was actually approached through Tom Dwyer, because they had worked with Frank as part of the documentary on recording some music. And they realized that they had their hands full working on the film, and they needed help on the label side to get the music out and get it to radio and media worldwide. And Frank really felt that for the first time in his career, he had the chance to just be himself and to put out the music that represented him and his story and his sound. And he was at last in control of his musical destiny, and it was received as such, and it was really just a beautiful, triumphant moment for him.
Yeah, and again, the incredible thing is now his album "All My Dues Are Paid" has been posthumously awarded with a Grammy nomination. We don't have a whole lot of time left. I would like to squeeze in one more sample from Bay's album called "All My Dues Are Paid," but the name of the song is "One of These Days." Again, he passed away in June, so kind of prescient, that title. Sally, so describe the absence of Frank Bay now in the blues world. What is missing?
What's missing is another one of those few left among us who were part of that whole blues resurgence that happened back in the 60s and has sort of continued on from there. You know, it's a link to that history and the roots of the music and someone who's actually lived the blues and isn't just playing the blues. It's a piece of history that's gone forever.
Tom, the documentary, I think the working title is "You're Going to Miss Me." One of the challenges apparently in producing the doc has been finding the funding to get to the finish line. Tell us about that.
Well, as you would expect, making any type of a film is expensive. And we're at our post-production stage now where we're just about to begin our editing. But we do need some money. The crazy thing is, you know, that nothing has changed with us, but this Grammy has come along and we look at it and we say, is this a gift from somewhere in the universe, Frank, to help us to get across that line? I mean, being on your show today is an example of this, you know.
We only have about 10 seconds. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I'm so grateful to be here. And yeah, we have a website. It's Frank Bay Film, www, of course. And please check it out if you're interested in learning more about this. But it's been an amazing road, and I'm just so grateful for having had Frank in my life and
thanks
for being able to do this. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Listen, John Lennon's Imagine became something of a signature for Frank Bay. We're going to go out on that show in just a moment. But Tom Dwyer, great to have you with us. Sally Bankston, to you as well. And as always, you can find us on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Diana Martinez is our engineer. Our producer, John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Well, well, well. No hell below us. Oh, no. And above us, only sky. So you just imagine all the people